Hello again, Will.
Hi, Rohan. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks. How are you?
Very well. We've had sort of unprecedentedly, if that's a word, nice weather recently.
That's really nice.
Yeah, very sunny. Hopefully, whenever people are listening to this, it's also very nice and sunny, so it fits with what's going on. But yeah, I was saying to one of my friends who was visiting, I don't think since I've been in Southampton, I've had like two nice sunny days in a row.
Yeah.
So this has been, I think we've had four or five, so it's been really nice. Is it nice in Oxford?
It's very nice in Oxford, yeah. Like we look out over the hills, the birds are chirping in the morning. So yeah,
Lovely.
It feels like I'm in a musical this time. Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, I think obviously everywhere is really nice, but I think like some of the older cities like London, Oxford, Cambridge, they look like particularly nice during the sun with like their buildings.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one of the things which is obviously it's good that housing has become more and sort of buildings in general have become a bit more practical because it means that more has been built and is more accessible. But it does mean that we don't have or we're not making as much anymore of really beautiful things which sort of stand out in the sun.
Like back in the 1700s or 1600s, people probably didn't think that what they were building was like amazing architecture, but then it just
they must have done.
Do you think?
Yeah, surely.
Yeah, but like when you're building a house, like a Victorian house, townhouse, like you wouldn't think, oh, this is amazing. It would just be like, this is the time, right? Like, say, like 200 years, people may look back on what we're building right now.
Okay.
As like large, you know, industrial level flats, it's like, wow, they're amazing. So
potentially, I mean, I don't think this isn't what we're going to talk about, but I don't think
neither of us are architects.
You know, just because I don't know about something doesn't mean I won't have an opinion on it. But I think we're already quite unkind to the architecture sort of 50, 60 years ago.
Right.
I don't know. I sort of feel like that's never going to change. I don't think anyone's going to turn around and be like, you know, those massive heaps of concrete. Those are beautiful. I'd be really surprised.
But if concrete becomes scarce as a resource, I mean, I don't know how this is logistically or even chemically possible, then would concrete become
like a status symbol?
Yeah. You know, like how, like, if you were fat, like really obese.
Yeah.
In the prehistoric times, that was actually like a good thing rather than a bad thing.
Yeah, you know, you might have an Edwardian palace, but look at my lovely concrete car park. Anyway, architecture aside, what were we going to be talking about today?
So today's a deep dive, and I thought this... So this was the first essay that I got set in my second year of medicine at Cambridge.
Mm.
I thought it was interesting enough, but also accessible enough to, like, an audience who hasn't perhaps done a first-year undergraduate degree to that we could actually have a stab at it, which is, obviously, with your background, which was, what does the brain do? So this is given by the late Roger Carpenter. He would kind of say this in a very metaphysical manner. What does the brain do exactly?
Mm.
But, you know, it was a really deep essay, and then he often used the word conceptual profundity. So Marx would be awarded for conceptual profundity, which I thought was a great phrase.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about actually why we need a brain. I mean, it's just something we take for granted.
Mm.
And, you know, what would happen if we didn't have one to a certain extent, right?
Yeah. I mean, so you could simplify the initial question by saying, do we need a brain?
Right.
Before you even say, you know, why, what function does it serve, you can answer, do we need it? Because there are lots of, I was going to say animals, but no, there are lots of organisms.
Right.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Lots of organisms that don't.
Right.
You know, the tree doesn't have a brain.
Mm.
And so, you know, and I think also the operant, one of the interesting words here is need. Mm. What does need mean?
Right. And also what is a brain, right? Because like there's the different levels of brain involved as well. So yeah, I mean, back then I just kind of said, well, the brain does I did the static classic undergrad thing, well, the brain does all these things and we need things to survive, therefore we need a brain.
Yeah.
But actually if you strip it all that way, as you just said, like a tree, like trees do move, like they don't move in the sense that we can perceive them.
Mm.
They do respond to stimuli, you know, in the broadest sense.
Mm.
The brain is just like something that's like a computer that's like processing stimuli and then outputting a response, essentially.
Yeah.
So, but there are other ways to kind of do that, like a normal stretch reflex. You don't even need a brain for that, for example. Like when you...
Yeah, I mean, you need a nervous system.
Right, but not a brain.
Mm. And even then, that's another thing that you can tease apart within this question. It's not a simple question.
No.
But, you know, I think certainly there are lots of things. And I think also we have a sense of what a brain is and what cognition is as well. Because there are lots of things that happen in your brainstem which you're not thinking about, and you might think are happening below a consciousness level, right? And again, you could sort of think, well, do we need consciousness, or do we just need sort of the fundamental heart rhythm, sort of pacemaking stuff that comes from your brainstem? But I mean, so why don't we start? It might be interesting to start if you can remember what your conclusions were from your essay in second year.
I think I went along as a computational mechanism, which I think a lot of my colleagues did, which was very similar to we need a brain because we have a lot of stimuli coming at us from our various sensory organs.
Yeah.
And in order to synthesize all of this information and produce a coordinated response, it requires essentially something to process that level of information.
Mm.
So that's why we need it. Because I defined brain as something that was beyond just like the physiological mechanisms needed to survive. So I said, you know, because there's like levels of brain, right? So there's like the basal ganglia, hypothalamus, but that's like the basic level, like what you'd essentially associate with like a primitive animal.
Mm.
Which is, if it gets cold, then you move into like an area in the sun. If it gets hot, then you move into the shade. Those kind of like,
yeah,
that's like basic level. But even, you know, even below that is, if I'm losing blood, then I need to increase my heart rate. Or if I'm stressed, then I need to release adrenaline and induce a flight or fight state. That's all fairly like lower levels. Like, I mean, it's still controlled by brain in air quotes.
Yeah.
But then at the higher levels is, you know, like, which is what humans can do, is things like, it's cold, let me put the thermostat on, let me put a sweater on, let me go inside, let me find a heating, external heater, let's all huddle together in a room to generate warmth.
Let me knit myself a jacket.
Install some insulation in my house.
Yeah.
All right, so those are things that you don't typically associate with animals. And the reason we can do that is, of course, we have the resources to, but more importantly, we have the ability to essentially problem solve. So like that's what the cortex that we kind of tend to think of is broadly about. So that's kind of like, that was my thesis. But actually, I remember Prof. Carpenter was actually really, interestingly, really, the one he really liked was actually the analogy to the tree, because he said everyone had approached it as, we need a brain to do these things. But actually, if you approach it as these other things, these other organisms can do the following, but they can't do these three or four things without a brain. And that's like a more compelling argument for why you need that extra structure, essentially.
Yeah.
So one of the best mentors I ever had was one of the things he taught me was, that often we'll say, well, you know, it's like in school, I don't know if you remember this, I was taught like, if a cell has lots of mitochondria, then it's a powerhouse and therefore it can like produce lots of energy.
Mm.
So that was often like the structure determines the function. But what he used to say is that's always taught really badly. Like it's always function that then determines structure, which I thought was like pretty profound. He's like, structure doesn't determine function, my boy.
Interesting.
So I was like, whoa.
I don't know if like, because there's a lot of, certainly in the stuff that we've been doing on ion channel receptors or just ion channels,
right?
A lot of the way that they behave is determined by the actual physical shape of the protein, right?
Develop because of the need of that function to arise.
Okay.
Because like, right. the protein and the human body and organisms will develop like that. That structure will, like, giraffes don't eat tall leaves because they are tall. They get tall because they want to eat tall leaves, for example.
Fine. All right. That's okay. I'm with him then.
Yeah. Okay. You've not just like blown away years of my principles of medicine.
Yeah. I mean, but I guess ultimately there will be people who specialize in structure and people who specialize in function, and they're both sort of approaching it from different ends, right? It's a similar question. I think it's interesting, this distinction between why do we have a brain and why do we need a brain, or why do we need a nervous system? Because they are very different questions. And I think from, you know, my answer in terms of why do we need a nervous system, and again, because you use organisms without a nervous system to sort of understand, I think it's the speed, right?
Yeah.
And I, you know, obviously, I know that you said that sort of Professor Carpenter would say that a brain is there to help you move. But I actually, you can move without a brain.
Yeah, like
without a nervous system.
Plants do. I mean, we've got plants in our house. Yeah. Move towards the sun and then like shrivel up at night.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you want to respond in real time to a potential insult, you need a nervous system that is able to operate at a sort of millisecond speed.
Yeah. You know, if someone says insult, he doesn't mean like a verbal insult. He means like a.
Yes. Well, the brain will help with those too. but you know, if you think about our tree, if someone starts to chop down the tree, there's very little it can do about it. It kind of just has to sort of say, it doesn't say anything, of course, but hopefully it will regrow. Hopefully once it's been chopped down, it loses most of the tree, but some can come back out of it. Whereas if someone tries to chop you down, for example, very quickly you can stop it.
Yeah, generally, you know, hopefully you'd run away.
Exactly. And I think when we're in terms of the question asking about need, it's just survival tactics.
Because
what does anything need to do? Well, ultimately, life wants to survive.
Yeah.
Or it needs to, is potentially a bit strong, but life wants to survive. And in order to survive, you can either develop the capacity to regrow regardless of what happens. So, you know, plants often have sort of unending, sort of undifferentiated stem cells, basically. A tree is enormously thick and strong and robust. So you either develop to be so strong and so hardy that whatever happens to you, it doesn't matter. Or you don't develop on the strong and hardiness side of things like us. You know, our skin's pretty soft. It's pretty damageable. But we're able to adapt in real time as things are happening to us. So it's a survival technique, really.
Yeah, interesting. Just on that note, you said that, you know, there's limited amounts a tree can do. So I found this out recently. This is kind of going to be my interesting fact, but I think I'll... But when you're on a walk and you're kind of like in a field and it's been raining recently, perhaps, and you just kind of get that really freshly mown grass kind of
smell. Yeah.
So do you know why that happens?
Amber will be very disappointed with me because she's told me the name of the sort of chemical that makes this. And I know, and she knows it because it came up in a Doctor Who episode. But I'm going to disappoint her and say, I can't say.
All right, on the record now, probably you can't take this back. So essentially it's the grass, whenever it gets cut, it releases like this. I don't actually know the name of it myself, but it releases this odor.
Yeah.
And you might be thinking, well, why does the grass bother doing that? And what they've discovered, like relatively recently, is that odor then attracts predators.
Okay. To stop whatever was the herbivore that was eating it.
Exactly. So, you know, like, yes, the grass individually can't do anything.
Yeah.
But it's like sending out a distress. It's almost like a warning sign.
Yeah.
You know, it's essentially like stopping further consumption of like neighboring grass.
Yeah, and I suppose it's again that it's that metric of speed, right? It can't respond in time to save itself.
Yeah, they can't just run away.
Yeah, but it can sort of set things up to help the overall survival.
And then there was like this documentary called, I think, Green Planet, and like David Attenborough talks about like trees excrete when one of their leaves starts getting chewed on by like caterpillars, they like start actively excreting certain toxins from their leaves, which then makes the caterpillars like dizzy or like makes them fall off or makes themselves taste really bitter, so they stop chewing on them. So you know, obviously plants have defense effect, but they are intrinsically much slower than just running away, for instance.
Yeah. So yes. So I'm sure sort of plant experts will be upset with how obviously my explanation earlier was a bit reductionist, right? A bit simple. But I think, overall, it is that sort of the speed of the response.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were talking about sort of reflexes. Mm. Even within our system of having a brain, we've got certain things which are sort of hijacked to respond even quicker. Yeah. Because there are certain things where that speed is even more important. You know, that we can ruminate on lots of stuff as long as we like. But if you're burning your hand and sort of wondering, this is unpleasant, you're going to cause some serious damage, right?
Let me think about it in great.
I'm going to evaluate the cost benefit of this pain.
Right. So I'm just trying to think if there are any organisms that don't have a... I mean, obviously there's organisms with a much smaller cortex.
Hmm.
Do you know any animals that like essentially don't have a cortex, like, or even a... They just have like a brainstem, or what we'd call a brainstem.
Okay, so they have sort of like a... They're just missing the brain.
Yeah, like a...
So there is... I mean, there's a developmental disorder where your neural tube doesn't sort of pinch off properly at the top, called anencephaly.
Yeah.
But I think... I don't know what sort of survival outcomes are. I think you die pretty quickly if you have that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's not.
I mean, the stories of like chickens like walking around, you know, for many days.
Yeah.
Essentially, and often they say decapitated. I suppose it's technically correct. But what they really mean is decerebrated, which is the cortex has been removed, but the centers in the brain, in the brainstem, are responsible for like respiration and.
Mm.
Ventilation and so on, like they're still alive, like the medulla oblongata still controls the breathing and the heart and stuff. So
I was gonna say I don't know, it would be an interesting case where it was sort of evolutionarily beneficial to go so far as to develop a whole central nervous system and a brain stem and not go any further.
But I mean, there'll be some organisms.
You'd have to catch it at a certain point in that development process.
Evolutionary lineage, which I'm sure, like some worms, for instance, have neurons. I mean, there's a worm, C. elegans, I think.
C. elegans, 302 neurons.
And we've mapped all of them. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure life started that way. But it's metabolically quite expensive to have neurons compared to like hormones. Like,
definitely.
Otherwise, why not just have... and if you're listening and you've got an Oxbridge interview coming up, this is a very common topic, which is, you know, why not just have everything done through nerves? Why bother with hormones?
Yeah.
It's because it's just so expensive metabolically.
And I suppose, it's that sort of not everything needs to be quick, right? So why waste the resources if you don't even want it to be quick in the first place? I mean, but what's interesting about invertebrate nervous systems is that they are, you know, they are quite different. If you take C. elegans, for example, it would be difficult to say this is where the brain sort of is, as much as it is for sort of mammals and birds. You know, there are certain areas where there are more clumps of the neurons.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, because it's on such a small scale, it's not got this sort of clear, defined morphological features which sort of separate it out as much.
I mean, you know, the other perception is people tend to think of like nerves and neurons as like these tiny little things that kind of just exist in isolation and then branch out to other tiny little neurons, but I mean, even in a human, some of the largest neurons stretch for more than a meter from like, the brain to the, you know, the foot, for instance. So,
But and I think that's
that long, right?
I think that's the fault of textbooks, actually, because in textbooks, you in pictures, when you, you know, you see this in GCSE when you're learning about the different kinds of cells, you see a little arm and then the cell body and a slightly bigger arm, but that's then sort of on top of another cell, which is just a little, you know, rectangle, and so you kind of think, certainly, the easy misperception is that across, you know, your arm, you've got these sort of tiny little cells all sort of next to each other going along, when and actually it's just sort of one massive long process from a dorsal root ganglia or wherever it's coming from.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? So I guess, you know, the reasons we need a brain, like obviously there's the approach of, well, you need it to coordinate a response to like multivariate stimuli across modalities and time. But that's a very like textbook answer, right? Like if you think of it, it's just purely you need it to move.
Yeah.
Are there any other kind of theses that we could put forward?
Well, I mean, I suppose you could also look at the why a nervous system started to develop in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. What drove that need? And there's a book which I might have mentioned on one of our previous episodes about sort of the development of intelligence by a philosopher called Peter Godfrey Smith. And he talks about sort of very early explosions of life and this sort of development of being in proximity to lots of other things. And for a long, very long time, all these animals sort of don't even know that the other animals are there because they don't have sensory receptors. They're just sort of all living in harmony with each other. But as soon as one animal develops by some mutation, the ability to notice what's going on around it, and then potentially to predate on it, you sort of develop this arms race.
Ooh, predate, I like that word.
So one answer could be we only need a brain because someone else had a brain. And that automatically puts you at a disadvantage if you're then competing with them for resources.
But that brain had to give some, again, brain in air quotes, because that thing is nothing like the brain we have now. But whatever that brain, rudimentary brain was, it had to confer a selective advantage, presumably. Because otherwise there would be no point developing a brain of your own.
Yeah, but that's sort of what I was saying, right? When the first, I mean, if you think on a really simple level, on a cell level, cells can communicate with themselves, right? You've sort of got things moving in and out of the nucleus and sort of gradually being turned over. When you develop multiple cells, you lose that ability as well. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly you've got this big organism with lots of little cells inside it, all doing their own thing, but nothing to coordinate it. And that's fine. That can operate and each cell can do its own thing and that can all survive. So long as there's, you know, a big abundance of whatever sort of food you need, lots of sort of food in the goo that you're living in. And again, as soon as one organism develops the ability to really sort of communicate within itself and interact with its surroundings, That is a huge advantage because you can move towards where there's more food goo, or you can move away from where there's sort of noxious stimuli. Why there would be noxious stimuli there, I don't know. And then if you want to, you know, if you're the organism next to it, and you're thinking, well, he's doing pretty well. He's got all the nice food, and he's also eaten most of my friends. Either you sort of develop in kind or you die.
Grow a brain just like because you really want one.
I mean, because, you know, it's Christmas, everyone else has got the brand new brain, and you're kind of thinking, well, I want one as well. I want to play with my friends.
Evolution in biology doesn't work that way, really. Like, surely there's a selection pressure, but that pressure wouldn't just come from. I suppose you're personifying a basal cell or a basal organism.
Yeah,
more than it needs to for the purposes of this, but
And I am in order to sort of illustrate, I suppose, a sense of agency within evolution, which often helps to understand evolution, but you need to understand that actually there's no real agency in evolution at all.
Yeah, sure. So I guess we've got three theories now. One is like coordinate responses. Second is to move. The third is just because the other guy had one.
And I also think another line of inquiry you could take is, well, what if we were to take away the brain now? What if we had the human and you just removed the brain or potentially the nervous system?
Well, that's quite an interesting. I mean, I think if you remove the nervous system, things would go wrong very, very quick. I mean, pretty much if you remove the nerves, you die straight away with instantly, I think. Well, would you? I don't even know how you perceive that. Yeah. I mean, there's the brain control. The brain's constantly inhibiting and slowing down the heart through the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
So the first thing that would happen is the heart would speed up, but that would require, again, the heart is a muscle and has its own nervous system. I mean, it's not a system, but it's a collection of nervous tissue which powers us. So I don't think life would be possible without nerves in their current paradigm.
So it's difficult, right, to imagine without it, because so much of what we are depends on it.
Yeah,
which is understandable.
It's a bit like saying what would happen without a skeleton. Like, it's just.
But I suppose actually that the way to remedy that is to say, okay, we've taken away the nervous system. What would we have to do without adding it back in to make this organism viable, right? Because we wouldn't be able to sort of necessarily eat, so we might need to be able to sort of photosynthesize. We'd have to be sort of self-sufficient to a degree. We wouldn't be able to predate anymore, and we'd also need to be more we'd probably want to be more robust to sort of outside stimuli.
But the stimuli is a really good one, because suddenly sight isn't possible anymore without nerves. You can get photosensitive cells, but I don't know if it's possible to have a response to them in real time without nerves, for instance.
But how do plants do it? Because they must, right?
Well, yeah, it wouldn't be real time, is I guess what I'm saying. So, like, plants don't know a sun is, I mean, again, plant enthusiasts, please do correct me, but... As far as I'm aware, plants don't know the location of the sun if it was to dramatically change in a few minutes. Like if you would suddenly move a light source from one end to the other of the plant, I don't think it would know that immediately. I think there would probably be a lag time. I don't know what the lag time would be, but it probably wouldn't be seconds. It'd probably be at least a few minutes, if not more. So sight wouldn't be a thing then?
No.
If there's no predation, then there's no need for taste. And the similar thing for hearing, hearing is pretty much completely neuronally dependent.
Yeah. I guess actually what this task requires is us for to be able to conceptualize what life would be like if we either didn't have a nervous system, but weren't a plant. Right. And it's quite difficult because I don't think we actually have that in the natural world, right? You sort of either have a nervous system or you're this sort of self-sufficient, very stationary organism that sort of doesn't need to sense per se or as much.
So I guess the question you're asking, can you move without a brain in quickly? And I think as far as I know, the answer is no.
Yeah.
I don't know anything that can move quick. Actually, I don't quite know how a Venus flytrap, because that's actually fairly quick.
It is.
But as far as I know, that doesn't have a brain.
No. And the motion is sort of cued by a very sort of stereotypical stimulus. I think it's just sort of that it happens whenever sort of rubs the inside of those little clam bits.
Yeah, and they've shown that it has like some level of short-term memory because, for example, it's got like sensors, and if you trip the first sensor, nothing happens. If you trip the second one, then it closes, for instance. Okay. There is a level of short-term working memory there, but they definitely don't have a brain. I mean, so...
But it potentially has some nervous apparatus, right? We don't know. Maybe here we look... What you found there is sort of this in-between, right? Which is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. So, you know, I think that's potentially what we could go down, isn't it? Like, essentially you turn into that level.
Yeah.
Where you'd need food. Either the food would have to be, like, in your immediate vicinity and you could just tap into it and then consume it. Which, yeah, plants too.
Yeah.
Or food would have to come to you, and then you'd have a mechanism of essentially consuming that food.
Yeah.
But again, doing so without too much speed.
So I guess if you don't want to have to make your own food, you need a nervous system. And that's because you need to be able to move quickly, right? It'd be interesting to see if there's a... Because we're talking about sort of speed and slow things and quick things. It'd be interesting to see if that where the threshold point is, where if it if you need to respond within a minute, can you get away without a nervous system? Or, you know, so you could say, why do we need a brain? And you could say, well, we need a brain if we wanted to respond to things within a 40-second time window or whatever that is.
Oh, we need a nervous system.
A nervous system, yes, sorry.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess the question would be like twofold, right? Like one is what's the kind of temporal threshold?
Yeah.
Time threshold that you need to kind of have to respond to that thing. But the second is what level of complexity of input and stimuli do you need?
Yeah.
In which point having a brain becomes metabolically justifiable. Because it's a huge, 25% of our blood flow goes straight to the brain.
Yeah.
Like it's a huge amount of energy that we're spending on it.
Yeah. It's an incredibly hungry system. And because, you know, there's so much that it needs to do, it's very easy to just say, well, this action potential sort of just travels, sends the signal up. But there's so much housekeeping that goes into that.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about this with the housekeeping. Like, I don't know any animals I don't know any, like, bacteria or amoeba or worms. They don't sleep, as far as I know. Whereas humans and most mammals, most animals do undergo sleep. And that is broadly for their brain.
Yeah. If you look at when you're asleep, your individual cells don't just sort of...
Right, like your heart carries on. You still carry on digesting and...
Yeah.
But I guess
there are certainly the way that your brain behaves changes.
So there was definitely a trade-off made or some concessions made when that brain developed as a result.
Right. If we want to be able to respond so quickly, then we're going to have to take time off.
Half the day. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, one thing that I find bizarre is hibernation.
Yeah.
It's something that I've never really read into too much, like academically. I've not read many papers on it, but I've just found it absolutely strange that, and I know our understanding, like the lay understanding of hibernation isn't quite correct. It's not that they just fall asleep forever. They're just sort of in a low movement period of their life. But to do that for sort of 5 months at a time or however long it is, yeah. Such a strange approach, it is, right? Like, again, to survival.
It's exposed, like,
yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're an enormous bear, you probably feel a bit more okay, sort of relaxing, because you know that no one's going to even try it. But still, you're right; it's super exposed, and it's a massive gamble. But yeah, I mean, there's another interesting question, and this comes to evolution is. Why do animals live as long as they live? And again, it's ultimately a gamble over survivability. If you can survive really well, Oh, no. I won't go into it because that would turn this into a very long thing. But it's just interesting, all these different things which happen for different animals. I often think just one thing about a brain rather than a nervous system is that I think that a brain allows for evolution within a generation. So any changes that happen to a plant, the way that a plant works, any sort of genuine changes to, I guess, their sort of genetic makeup and the way that they are as an organism, typically takes thousands and thousands of years to occur. And the more you develop a nervous system, I think that the more you can, obviously you're not speeding up evolution, but you're creating sort of a faster version of change. Where in a lifetime, the way that you behave, the way that you do things can change hugely. And that's quite interesting. I guess we're looking at not only speed of reaction times of a millisecond, but also the speed of how you change as an organism over time. It's very difficult if you're slow responding, but if you're quick responding, you can change, one person a year on is very different to who they were a year before, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of like anthropomorphic, right? Like if you're a stegosaurus, I mean, admittedly, you have a small cortex, so you can't change that much compared to your breed. But the ability to pass on what you know through like written word and records will then just allow quicker developments.
Yeah.
Because you're changing like the status quo.
Yeah.
Suddenly not everyone's starting in the same position, having to work things out. You've got like the benefit of building on people's knowledge. Like, I mean, in our case, like if I was born with like in ancient Greece, like there's maybe a chance, I'd like to think that I might have stumbled upon like Pythagoras' theorem, but
wouldn't that be good?
But there's a very good chance I wouldn't, right? Whereas like now it's just so obvious.
Yeah.
Whereas back then that must have been like huge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, ultimately I don't think we do need a brain. An organism doesn't need a nervous system. We know that because there are organisms that don't have it. The more interesting question is, why would you want a brain? Because it sort of enables a lot more, well, not necessarily interesting, because actually plants do ridiculous things, crazy interesting things. But I suppose it allows for potentially a lot more change, a lot more new stuff to happen. But I mean, you could argue actually that's not necessarily... Maybe that's characteristic of certain brains, but not all. There are lots of vertebrates with brains that don't sort of have that same. I don't know. I think animals' behavior is very interesting as well. It's tricky.
Well, what we've learned is Will likes biology and he finds it interesting. So no surprises there.
Yeah, that's good to hear, right? It'd be a bit of a shock if I was 5 minutes in, I was like, actually, I don't care about this one.
Cool. Okay. Well, we should probably wrap up. So I guess, yeah, there's various theories as to why we need a brain, but more importantly, why we have one.
Hmm.
It's like kind of a more philosophical question to a certain extent.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. All right. Well, anything last words before we kind of move on to facts?
Before we move on to facts, no, I'm happy. I feel like I've said my piece.
Okay. Well, mine relates to brains.
Yeah.
Incidentally, by complete chance. So, there's two things, actually, and they're kind of like mini facts. The first thing is it annoys me quite a lot whenever I kind of hear like pop psychologists say we only use 5% of our brain and the other 95% is like, it's like, so I want to like, use this opportunity to dispel that and say that it'd be an incredibly inefficient system if we only did use 5% of our brain for the metabolic energy that it normally requires. So we do use pretty much all of the cortex. I think probably the misconception comes from like back when the neuroanatomy was still like being kind of, a new field, they were looking at the gray and white segments of the brain and they thought the white segments were the critical part and the gray just didn't do anything. Well, it does a lot more than just nothing right now. So,
yeah.
So yeah, it's just one of those, th- things that's specific. But the other interesting thing is, loads of people obviously talk about the central nervous system, but not many know that the enteric nervous system, the gut, essentially has its own brain, like a mini brain. So, you know, like it's not as big as the brain, but actually it's still substantial. There's about 800 million neurons in it. And in fact, there's loads of people and researchers that say that the gut controls a huge amount of not just like stuff to do with your body weight and your hormones, but also like much higher level activity, like bone mineral density and general mood. And it's done through the enteric nervous system, a lot of this. So,
yeah, it's a big deal. And I think it's within the scientific community, there's an understanding that it's been broadly pretty neglected. So I was at the sort of Alzheimer's research.
Like to research the gut brain rather than like the brain.
Yeah. And I think also whenever you move into a new field, it's always difficult, right? It always gets adopted slowly. There's a couple, you know, researchers, lab groups that really pioneer it. And then a few others join on and a few others join on. But I was just saying at the this year's conference, you know, there's a sizable segment on the gut brain axis, and looking at sort of the dynamics that has, around sort of, more broadly sort of, diseases whereby there's misfolded proteins, but also in Alzheimer's disease. So it's certainly something which is gaining a lot of traction. Did you ever see the film Lucy? It's rubbish. So don't. But basically the premise is people only use 5-10% of their brain.
She takes a drug. I have seen this.
Sort of by about 60%, she can read everyone's mind. And by 80%, I don't know, she's sort of turned into this meta being. It's infuriating. I hated it. But yeah, don't watch it.
Yeah, it's just, I think there was another drug which like, you know, there was another film, similar film where you take this drug and it unlocks 95% of your brain or something, and something. Yeah. This guy like can remember everything that's ever happened and can like start projecting and processing what will happen.
Yeah.
And there are individuals who can do that, but it's not because they can, they have 100% use of their brain.
Yeah. Yeah. So my fact this week is actually, this is from a article that I was reading. News article I was reading last week about new legislation. I mean, what an interesting life I live. New legislation about the use of recyclable plastic in packaging. This is, you know, the exciting lifestyle of a student. And it got me thinking. So basically, the lots of the packaging companies were very upset because they were going to get taxed more. And it got me thinking a bit about our episode we did a while ago about COP26 about sort of, because you see a lot of information about plastics in the ocean. And I thought, okay, it feels like there's a lot, but how much actually is there? Like, what are we talking here? And there's variation in the estimations. But at the top estimates, the total amount of sort of plastic in the ocean is approximately, by my account, about equal in mass to the mass of the entire North American population, plus the South American population, plus the European population. So it's quite a lot of plastic floating around. I hadn't really. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, the biomass is equivalent to the population.
Yes. So if you, I think I modeled the average person's weight at about, I think it was 80 or 85 kilograms. I think it was 85 kilograms of a person that a person weighs.
Primary research that you're doing.
it's going to be published. There's a little space in nature waiting for it.
The Two Blues Journal coming to you soon.
Yeah. Only publishing interesting facts and related research that goes into them.
Okay, but I mean, is that?
Yeah, I think we'll call it there. Or have you got? You wanted to talk about the plastic?
Not that. No, I mean, it sounds like a lot, but is it? I mean, the oceans are oceanic. Like they're oceans, right? Like they're huge.
They are huge, and what's interesting is in the sort of 20th century, the approach was the oceans are so enormous that we can just dump whatever we want in it and it will sort of equilibrium it. Because it's so big, right? You know, if we're putting a little bit of plastic in, what does it matter? It will sort of all disintegrate and sort itself out.
Well, this is it, you know, because if you tell me there's a chunk of plastic that's the size of me in the Pacific somewhere, like in the depths of one of the oceans.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be that bothered by it. But if you told me that there was 5 billion kilos, that's about right, of plastic, then that's just so hard to imagine. So it's kind of like, how do you convince people? How do you make it relatable?
Yeah. And because numbers on that size are meaningless, right? It just becomes like if you talked about like the cubic square meter of the ocean, yeah, it would just be a huge figure that means absolutely nothing. So you do have to relate it to
other stuff. I found a way of explaining this actually. So it wasn't about the oceans, but it did involve them, which was, I think someone was trying to show people how long a billion years was. I don't know if you heard this. So
no, I haven't. But again, it's another concept which is really difficult to grasp, right?
Yeah. So, and it's just, you know, so alien to us. So he said, the exact numbers may be off, but because it's secondhand now. But if you walk around the Earth yourself, just like walking on barefoot,
mm-hmm,
imagine every time you complete a circumference of the Earth, you put a piece of paper down. Every time you walk around the surface of the Earth, you take a jug of water out of the ocean and then throw it into space. So it escapes the Earth.
Yeah.
And you keep doing that until the oceans are empty. When the ocean is empty, you put a piece of paper on to the floor and then the ocean's water refills the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And then you keep doing that. And every time you empty the oceans, you put another piece of paper down. And when that piece of paper, the stack of papers, reaches the moon, is how long it would take for a billion years to allow.
See, that's ludicrous, right?
Right, exactly, right? Can you imagine that?
Yeah. That's, a long time.
Like, I just can't even imagine.
That's great.
That's much more relatable than a billion years, which I'm like,
Yeah.
That's not much more than a million, but...
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I think we've solved the brain.
Yeah.
Who knows what else we can achieve? I think so. Next week, we're going to be picking some of our favorite subjects at Oxford and Cambridge. Right. And in order to reduce bias, I will be picking the most interesting looking subjects at Cambridge. To me, of course, this is all sort of personal opinion. And Rohan will be picking his three most interesting looking subjects at Oxford, right?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, fantastic. I'll see you then.
Researching. Yeah, bye. Cool, cheers. Cheers, Will. Bye.